Accession number 17543, Reel 2.
Mr. Fenton, Reel 2. Anything to add about the Vortrekkers?
Not really. You bypass them, really. I mean, you were told at the camp, you know, by your commandants to have little to do with them, you know. But there were some good South Africans. They weren't all bad, but there was just this element that were. And you kept well away from them, you know. But it was a dreadful neck of the woods, as I say. The heat was immense, and the sand and everything blew, and that. I suppose I thought if you got out there, there wouldn't be any women to take you away from the job you'd gone to do, because there certainly weren't any. But anyway, we did our training for 3 months there, and then we went up to a place called, on the coast, called Port Alfred, where we did a gunnery course and a bombing course as well. They were separate from your navigation, you see. You then went on to gunnery. I don't know if you know the categories in the Air Force, but there is a navigation brevi with N on. I don't know if you've seen. Well, they were just pure navigators. Our brevis in the early days, which we're talking about, had an O, which was observer, which embraced bomb aiming, gunnery and navigation. You did the three. Because when we went out there, four engine bombers weren't around very much then, if you know what I mean. It was aircraft like Wellingtons and Blenheims. It was only when the four engine jobs came on did they specialise as navigators only.
How did you get on with these other aspects of being an observer?
Well, it's thoroughly enjoyable. You couldn't help but enjoy it, you know. I mean, bombing was terrific. You used to go out into the Indian Ocean there, and there was all these targets and that, and I mean the visibility was so good, it was unbelievable. You could see your bombs, you know, these weren't explosive bombs in the they weren't for 500 pounds or anything like that, but you could see them hit the target. It was great fun, you know. And then of course on the gunnery courses you had aircraft towing drogues. I don't know if you know what a drogue is, but it's, you know, a drogue. And then you had coloured bullets that when you came down after after doing your course, they'd look in the drogue to see if your coloured bullets, where they'd gone in, you see, and they gave you a percentage score from that as to how well you'd done. Well, it was great fun, was that? I mean, everybody liked that, you know.
How were you and the others, do you think, regarding the prospect of getting into the war?
Well, we were having such a good time in many ways because the people were very hospitable. We had quite a few holidays with people who entertained us, you know, and they were very kind to us out there because we had rest periods. We weren't absolutely heads down all the time. We had weeks off, like holidays and things like that, because of another course coming in, or because, you know, they weren't ready for us. And they'd say, oh, well, you'll be off next week. You know, sort of, and you could go to a place called Tok H, which is had a Tok H in this country as well. You used to go there, and there was always on the wall, there were little notices, can accommodate two airmen for a week, you know, sort of, if they care to get in touch with Mrs. whoever, and they'd take you in. I've had some great holidays out of them, some great.
What was Tok H, a canteen?
Well, Tok H was a young people's organisation. It was from the Great War, I believe, Tok H started. I don't know the background of it. But it was something similar to British Legion, but in a smaller way. But it was quite big out there, you know, because they had ladies who prepared food and tea and this sort of thing, and they got involved. And this is how it all started, you know. But we were always, I've been in national parks, I've seen lion kills, I've seen all sorts, so courtesy of these sort of people, you know. Had some wonderful times with them.
Was Tok H in Port Alfred?
No, it was that was in Joburg, actually. But we had connections. There was always something going up on the notice board telling you to get in touch with, you know. But in Port Alfred, I mean, there was a... I forget what there was there was some organisation They couldn't do enough for aircrew, quite frankly, the whole lot of them, except for these other people I talk about.
So what happened next?
Well, we did our training and then we went down to Cape Town and we went back on the Duchess of Richmond went out on, and it's on my logbook there.
That's,
I think,
Empress of Australia.
The Empress of Australia we came back on. Now, the Empress of Australia was the last boat out of Singapore, and when we stood on the quayside and looked up at this massive great ship, we saw women on board on a troop ship. Well, this was unbelievable. We just couldn't get it in our heads why women should be on board. And what a lot had happened, a lot of Eurasian Singapore women had married British soldiers to get the nationality so they could come home before the Japs took over there, you see. And a lot of these ladies were on this ship coming to England with the families and this sort of thing. So we used to have some gay old times, you know, the dances and all that sort of thing going on, and it was not quite like a troop ship in some ways. It was quite different to the one we'd gone out on. We enjoyed ourselves rather. Anyway, we got home in peace. Winston Churchill's son was on board there. There was army on board as well, and Randolph Churchill was on the ship, and he was in charge of sort of all the entertainments for the troops and that sort of thing. I got to know him quite well, actually. He was quite a nice fellow.
How did you get to know him?
Well, I mean, we all met. See, it's a great leveller, his war, you know. I mean, you talk to everybody and anybody, you know. You're all doing a job of work. And I used to look after the RAF side on the social side, and he looked after the army, and that brought us together, you know. We had concerts and things like that, you know. But I remember once, a laughable thing, we used to do duties behind Beaufort guns. These ships had Beaufort guns on board, and they were in concrete blocks and that. And, you know, you'd have your list of when you were on and when you weren't. This particular day I was in the hairdressing saloon having my hair cut, and the air raid buzzer went, so we had to dash up to your party, see. So we get there, when I get there, everybody had got a tin hat but me. There was no tin hat for me, so I thought, well, I keep very low here. And in the distance, this is coming up to Northern Ireland, by the way, in the distance you could see these aircraft, little, very small, and there's good, well trained air crew. We should have known them by aircraft recognition. So we start off. God, it's a Focke-Wulf Condor. The Junkers, they were all the Germans. We had all the Germans, you know. So they got, and all of a sudden, somebody said, "Well, the Sunderland flying boats." But the gunners were going like this, you know. And we were supposed to know aircraft recognition. It was just one of those silly things that happened. Anyway, from there we.
Any memories about Randolph Churchill?
Not particularly. He said he turned out to be an absolute tough of a gentleman. You know, I mean, he was army coming back. I think he'd been up in the desert. You know, that's and they were coming down back home, some of them. But he just was a normal type of man.
Sorry, I interrupted you with your coming back into Britain.
Oh, yes, well, we came back and then we went on leave, of course. We were all fully fledged sergeant navigators or pilots or whatever your category was. And came home on leave. Your parents were extremely pleased to see you because they hadn't seen you for quite some considerable time. And then, of course, the real thing began then. But you were very much a sprog air crew. You had to really learn your trade when you got back here, you know, because they put you on proper aircraft which were doing the job. I went down to Harwell, you've heard of Harwell, I went down to Harwell, and we trained there for a while on Wellington bombers, doing what we call cross countries. And also you got crewed up there. This is where you got crewed up. And as far as what happened was this, how they crewed you up was this. You went into a big hangar and there was just a mass of bodies of all categories of aircrew. Pilots, navigators, bomb aimers, flight engineers, they're all milling around, and you'd go up to somebody and say, are you crewed up yet? Have you got anybody? And you didn't know any of them. You didn't know who you're talking to. And for a while I sat back and I just watched all this milling around going off, and there was a chap on his own and he looked pretty lonely, and he was in a corner and nobody had approached him. So I went up to him, I said, you are in aircrew, because he had a pilot's wings up. He said, yes, I'm just looking round. Oh, I said, like me? He said, I'm just taking stock. I said, I'm doing exactly the same. And he turned out to be, he was a fighter pilot, and he was what they called a scrubbed. They'd scrubbed him because he was an older man. Ted Cranwell, who was the chap I'm talking about, at that age, he'd be about 26 or 7, would Ted, then. And he hadn't got the reflexes. They wanted young bucks to be fighters, you see. He'd been in hurricanes and things of that sort, but they said the best place for you is to remuster onto bombers, and that's why he was there. But he'd got flying hours under his wing, you see, which was a big, big thing. So we got talking, we crewed up, we got a crew together. We'd one Australian, we'd one Canadian in the crew, and the rest of us were Brits, you know. So that was our crewing up, and then we went off to Harwell, did our training in Wellington's. Again, we had, what shall we say, about 6 to 8 weeks training, you know, cross countries, night flying, fighter affiliation, all sorts of things we did there. The first 1,000 bomber raid that was had, they took aircraft from trading establishments to make the 1,000 up. They weren't all from squadrons because they hadn't enough aircraft to make a 1,000 up. Now, you must bear in mind that these aircraft that I'm talking about now, that were on OTUs, had been doing what we call circuits and bumps day in and day out, and they were virtually clapped out, you know. I mean, they've been roughly handled, obviously. Now, when you went to Cologne there, I mean, there were Stirlings and that had a ceiling of maybe 15,000. The ones we were on barely got up to 9. And they were in tiers above you, you see, and it was a bit dicey. You could have got killed by your own chaps just dropping bombs like that, you know. So
So you went on this 1,000 bomber raid?
Well, I didn't. That's another story, is that we took off and we had to return. Because, as I just said, the aircraft was not serviceable. We couldn't make the height, and we had to come back. It was an abortive raid, as far as I was concerned. My friends who I was with, they went and came back, but I didn't. But that was the reason the aircraft was just clapped out, you know. So that was the end of that little episode.
And then?
Well, then after that, when they thought you were fully competent to go onto a squadron, I came up to Pocklington onto Halifax's on 102 squadron, and then you just did a few little cross country flights just to get accustomed to the new aircraft, which was a 4-engined aircraft. After you'd been on a 2-engine job, you got to acclimatise yourself and become acquainted with 4-engined aircraft. My first trip everybody got one of these, a real easy trip to sort of give you a bit of confidence, was Mine Lane off the Frisian Islands, a place called Ameland. And you went in low at about 500 feet and you were laying mines, because this was where the coasters and all the traffic used to go up and down, and used to lay these mines so that German ships, you hoped, would hit them. And that was your first job. But that was more or less to give you a little bit of confidence in that.
what was it like flying into Halifax?
The big thing was, what I've got to say now about Bomber Command is this, it was a team job. Everybody at some time or other was called upon to do his job, to save the lives of the crew, be it the rear gunner, the mid-upper gunner, the pilot, the navigator. You all, sometime on these ops, one man had to know his job to get you out of trouble, you know. It was a real team job, was Bomber Command. And you got there and you worked hard and played hard. And you had great faith in everybody. Everybody had faith in each other. There was no... I've never known men come together so much as a team as I did in those days.
Can you tell me about the rest of the crew, who they were?
Well, Ted Cranwell, he was from Romford in Essex. As was Ron Skinner, he was another London boy. My favourite there of the crew, if there was one, was an Australian, was my wireless up, called Darby Munro, came from Wagga Wagga in Australia. And then the mid-upper gunner was a chap called Fawkes, F-A-U-L-K-E-S. We used to call him Guy Fawkes, that's what we used to call him. And he came from Canada, did Guy, you know. And that was more or less the makeup. The flight engineer, I think he came from the Midlands, did Howard, came from the Midlands somewhere. But we're a mixed crew, very mixed. But having said that, I also flew with other people other than that crew. I went with, I don't want this to sound big-headed, but as I got more and more trips under my belt, I was getting more and more experienced. And flight commanders would go with Sprog navigators, the wanted chaps like myself who'd got 20... You'll see Squadron Leader Marshall in there. I flew with Squadron Leader Marshall, who was the flight commander. I did Berlin with him, you know. And he only took you because you were an experienced body at that time. But one of the most amazing things that really happened was we were over Essen one night with my own crew, and two engines gave out, and the captain said, Ted Cranwell said, ready for get to the escape hatches, we're going down. So I quickly put on my parachute, jumped down at the back, and when I got there, already there were three chaps at the entrance ready to jump. And this chap, this Guy Fawkes, this Canadian, there were two spars at the back, and we looked down, and it was just an inferno. There was everything. There was fires, there were searchlights, there was guns going off. It was dreadful. Anyway, he was hanging on there, and he'd frozen. You couldn't move him. He had his Irvine jacket on, and we were pushing him. We were kicking him with our feet to get him out, and he wouldn't let go. Now, this is one of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me. Near to the entrance there, don't ask me why, there was an intercom plug, and you had your helmet on and you could plug it in. And I plugged into this intercom. As I say, don't ask me why I did it. I should have been jumping out. Ted Cranwell said, hold on, chaps. One of the engines is picking up. Don't go, you see. Well, of course, we try then to pull Guy Fawkes in, but no, he won't come in. No, he's going to go. So, to cut a long story short, we eventually get him in, because he's slipping out of his Irvine jacket, you see. He's going away through his Irvine jacket. We all get it on, and we're about 18,000 feet, and we pull him in, and we all collapse on the floor through lack of oxygen. We're absolutely out. None of us could breathe. We're all there like dead. Anyway, to cut another long story short, We crash landed at Manston coming back, and we all escaped. That was possibly one of the worst trips I had. That
was at Essen?
That was at Essen.
Well, according to your logbook, there are two Essen races.
Oh yeah, well, I've done it. I did two Essens, yes.
Which one was it? Do you remember, the first or the second?
It was the first one.
Well, that was March the 12th, 1943, according to this.
Well, if it's in the book there, it would be that. And the other one was, we did another tricky job, which was Wilhelmshaven, and we were after the Tirpitz, the battleship, the Tirpitz, then, and they were putting up what they call a box barrage. They put the guns used to put up a big box barrage, and you got to fly through this. And it was a heavy. The clouds were absolutely thick, and freezing was terrible, and you could hear chunks of ice building up on the propellers, and as you went through they were hitting the fuselage like that, and the aerodynamics of the aircraft were absolutely going all to pot, and we were dropping like a stone. Luckily we got away with it that night. How we did I don't know, but we were very heavily iced up that night.
Again, you've got two Wilhelmshaven operations.
It was the second one, second night. First night it was clear.
Well, the first night was 18th of February 43.
The other one 19th, was it?
Yeah, according to the logbook.
That's right. Well, it was the second night. The first night was clear, and we didn't do the job we'd been sent to do, i.e. we didn't make any hits on the Tirpitz, so they sent us out the second night to do it, you see. But the one I flew with Squadron Leader Marshall when we went to Berlin, on the course into Berlin, what they used to do is they used to drop what they call chandelier flares, and these flares were on parachutes, and they used to light up all the sky. It was like going down Piccadilly Circus, you know, and these fighters used to be on the side, just on the side there, and you had, if you were going to your target, you had to go through this avenue of flares, and they used to pick you off as you went through. They could pick, it was like daylight, well it was more than daylight, and they used to just zoom in and you know, pick you off from that. We got strafed once or twice. We got away with it, but the number of aircraft that went down that night was quite enormous, quite frankly. You know, you'd no chance. They just used to pick you off, and that was it, you know.
Could you see them coming down?
Oh, you could see them. You could see them. Well, as I say, it's just like daylight, you see. It was like a daylight operation. But these flares hung on parachutes and just hung suspended all the time, you know. However, we got away with that one, and that was it. So, all in all, I had great fortune in my tour, quite honestly.
Any other of the operations you did that stick out particularly in your mind?
The last one there, it's called Le Cruzo. I think you'll see the last one I did. Le Cruzo in France, in mid-France, near Lyon.
This is 19th of June 1940.
That was my last one I did on the score, yeah. And this one was a low-level job, and we were to bomb what they call the Schneider Works. There were big armaments and that, you know, manufacturers. And it was a low-level job. We used to go in at about 500 feet, drop your bomb. And it was a wonderful moonlight night. It was the easiest operation I ever did. There was absolutely nothing you could say. You would think it was peacetime. And we got to this factory and we looked down there. The moon was shining on it. There was a railway engine at the side. You could see it. It was like a Hornby train, you know, and it was puffing smoke out. And we just went round. We dropped our bomb, and you could see this. You could see it just as though it was a tin can. The ceiling of this factory just opened up as the bomb went in. There was a big explosion, and this train just went up in the air and turned on its side. I'll never forget that. And there was absolutely nothing there. There's no sort of fighters or anything, and you could see this and you could watch things, and that'll ever stick in my memory with that. Just, it was all slow motion. It just seemed to be everything was going in slow motion, but there was no danger as far as the thing went, but the factory got wiped out, obviously, you know. So that was a goodbye to that.
Which was your most unpleasant raid, do you think?
Berlin, definitely, because you could see so many aircraft going down that, as you will see when I show you this tape, the only thing that ever got to me, I mean, you didn't bother a lot. It was a job of work to do. I mean, we're all frightened to death, quite frankly, but you did it. But the only thing that ever got to me was this. I used to share a room with another officer, and when you'd done one or two operations, the bed next to you, a chap would come in and say, "What's it like?" And you'd tell him, you see. He'd do two or three ops, he'd go missing. Another newcomer would come in, you maybe had about 10 or 12 under your belt then. He'd come in and might do one and he went missing. And by the time you were climbing up to your 20s and that, the law of averages told you that it just couldn't go on. And in the room I had, there were six men in that bed to my one. And when you were getting up to 28 and 29, I mean, you knew it just couldn't go on. And this was the only thing that used to get to me. And of course, you made friends with these people as well, you know. They were friends of yours and that. And as I say, over the period of time I operated, I reckon I lost about six good friends just like that. Because you often wonder, well, I must go soon. It was pretty obvious you couldn't go on forever, you know. But anyway, that was it, and you got away with it. We have reunions now where we meet up and, you know, you meet chaps who 50 years ago were your pals, and that's, it's a wonderful thing. We've just had one now at York University a fortnight ago where we've all been together, you know, 102 squadron.
Did you know that you had a specific number of operations to complete?
Oh, you had to do 30 in your first tour. I did 29, actually. I got away without the extra one. Because, quite honestly, at times, aircrew, as I was finishing in 43, there were a lot of aircrew coming up. There was a gap, if you know what I mean, getting them. But then all of a sudden there was a big bulge and they wanted to get you out. And also, as I said, they wanted people of my experience to go and train other people. This is what they were really after, you know. So I was sent on a special navigation course and I got a high class navigation certificate. In fact, I could have gone with BOAC at that time. After the war, it was a high quality navigation certificate. And then I took over as a station navigation officer and trained them on what they called a heavy conversion unit. I used to train navigators. Well, I hired a team, of other officers, and I was in charge then.
So what condition were you in by the time you'd finished your 29 ops?
Good question. I was so thankful, it just wasn't true. You couldn't believe it, you know. But the crowning glory was the fact that I was decorated, I got a DFC, and I was able to take my mother and father and my sister to the palace, and I suppose that really was the big payoff as far as I was concerned. It was a very proud day for me.
And any of these other operations that you've got noted down in your logbook, like Nuremberg Stuttgart, that you remember?
Turin and places like that. Yeah, you obviously haven't read all the log sheets there, but you had your moments, you know. But generally speaking, not boasting as a navigator, but if a navigator knew what he was doing and kept to. You see, there were times you were given when you had to be at a certain place where you know, a mass number to be there. And navigation was all about getting there. And if the wind's changing, you hadn't noted it in your navigation, you could be miles off course. And then you were a single aircraft which were picked out by the Germans and knocked hell out of. But if you kept together in a gaggle, it was sort of much better off.